And welcome back to the Pomp and Joe Show. Jason Mackey, Austin Bechtold with you here, usual hours, but the substitute teachers in the studio. First hour flew by. Really excited about our next guest going out to the fan hotline where we find Garrett Webster, son of Mike Webster. And this is an important time, an important anniversary. It's been 20 years, like I said, since Dr. Bennett Amalu's study of Mike Webster's brain appeared in the journal Neurosurgery. And Garrett does a fantastic job carrying on his dad's legacy, making sure people know about his dad. And it's a good time to reflect on stuff that's gone better. We're still not all the way there. I wrote a little bit about this and talking to Garrett and Pam Webster. Garrett, what's going on, man? How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for hopping on with me. I appreciate it. And
go ahead. Anytime. I got my big bag of Sour Patch Kids and my dog at my feet. I'm ready to roll here.
How big of a bag we talking?
Oh, it's big. It's one of them. You go to Costco, you get the probably enough to feed a small village of children. It's good. It's just the right amount of stale, you know, not where it's too fresh so it sticks to your teeth. Just got that little bit of staleness in it, so it's kind of got some firmness. So it's about as good as it can get right there.
All right. I love it. And it's your day off. From what I understand, you said today was a lot easier. So you got a day off eating Sour Patch Kids, hanging with your dog, talking on the radio, man. Life is good. I appreciate it.
That's right.
All right. So I'm starting kind of serious off the top, though. We'll get to some fun stuff a little later. And I know it's kind of broad, but I did want to talk about the length of time between your dad's passing and what we've learned about CTE and the time and that sort of thing. Just how would you describe the advances that have been made with diagnosing and treating head injuries over the past 20 years? And, you know, maybe what else would you like to see happen?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing is, like you said, is studying the brain and getting more information on how these injuries happen and how it affects people. That's the biggest thing that has had advancements. You know, I think that during my dad's time and really up until, you know, those early 2000s, medical technology was at a point where it could only really examine the brain so much. And I think, you know, we as human beings were kind of used to, if somebody's hurt, if somebody's injured, we can see the injury. You know, somebody's got a broken leg, somebody's missing an arm or something. I know that sounds funny, but, you know, at the end of the day, that's, you know, how you kind of are used to things, diagnosing it, looking at it. But because of how much, you know, medical science has advanced, you know, they can do certain scans and stuff like that to really kind of look in both, you know, post-mortem after somebody's passed away and while they're still alive, to see what kind of shape guys are in. And that to me has been the best part, watching, you know, the advancement and the acceptance of the risk of head injuries, not just in football, but in other areas of life and how sensitive the brain is. You know, I always like to say, you know, we always for the longest time, you know, took it as an acceptance. If somebody keeps spraining their ankle, you know, an arthritic condition or something would happen in the ankle that we would be more cognizant of. And for whatever reason, you know, for the longest time when it came to the brain, the most, you know, important, you know, part of our body anyways, we kind of didn't really think like that, mainly because we couldn't see the injuries or, you know, behaviors and stuff like that were very subtle. But that's changed, you know, and I think that with football being so popular, you know, especially in America, it's really kind of been that key to really kind of open that up, that discussion up to other areas. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when Magic Johnson was diagnosed with AIDS, not comparing my dad to Magic Johnson or anything like that. But it was that, you know, kind of public figure or public kind of, you know, what do they call it? Flashpoint or something like that, that really kind of got more people open-minded and more cognizant of talking about the issue.
Another thing that you brought up when we met, and we're talking to Garrett Webster, Mike Webster's son, about CTE issues, and it's been 20 years since Dr. Bennett Amalu's study of Mike Webster's brain. Another thing that you guys talked about was that resources for people affected by those with CTE and, you know, specifically in the NFL and resources have changed. You know, you guys obviously were, you know, the first one through the wall, so to speak. I know you used the term first domino to fall. But you talked about resources being different now. Can you describe a little bit about that and how it has changed?
Yeah, I mean, when, you know, in 2002 or let's say, you know, that the post-retirement period of my dad, you know, there were not a lot of resources, not just in the NFL, but anywhere really when it came to head injuries. You know, it was something that was whether you want to call it because it was hard to verify or because it was unknown or it was, you know, the stereotypical, well, let's just stick our head in the sand and hope it's not a real thing. You know, there wasn't a lot of support, resources, whatever you want to call it, for head injuries. You know, I think it was still, we were still in that time period where if somebody had mental issues, it was, you know, just walk it off or just they'll eventually feel better or, you know, you shouldn't be sad or you shouldn't be depressed or, you know, like with my dad, you know, and we even as a family thought, well, this is the normal, you know, post-retirement situation with anyone, not just athletes, but I think anybody who's had a long-term job, you know, they notice a change in behavior and we just thought he would kind of snap out of it. And, you know, obviously over time that didn't happen. And with dad and with a lot of other people that I've talked to, not just football players that have had head injuries, you know, the understanding of that has changed and it's become more accepted that, you know, they're long-term problems. And there was that period, you know, after the paper was published and stuff like that, where, you know, unfortunately we are a litigious society and stuff like that, where, you know, you get into that thing where it's more concerned about who's got the blame or who failed or who did wrong. And it's not focused on the people who are suffering right then. You know, but now that we've become, you know, like you said, 20 years since the paper was published, you know, I even know, you know, for a fact that I've seen or been on the receiving end or heard other people talk about, especially, you know, in football, there's now, or, you know, organizations or I don't know what the term is exactly, departments, I guess, would be the closest thing I can think of with, you know, the NFL to get out there and reach out and get these guys some help. You know, there's, you know, the Players Care Foundation, which does a lot of really good work with helping guys, whether it be with setting them up with psychiatrists or getting them looked at medically, or even guys that maybe weren't as successful or didn't make the money that some of the guys do now. Not that it's all about money, but at the end of the day, you know, guys got to pay their bills and, you know, take care of their families. And somebody with a head injury is not the best financial manager and also has a lot of medical stuff that needs to be done and stuff, you know, medications to take and stuff like that. You know, there's now organizations to help guys with that. You know, there's still more stuff that could be done when it comes to, you know, reaching out and talking to the families of some of these guys. Because again, you know, these guys, especially professional athletes, they've got a lot of pride and they got a lot of, you know, you can call it ego or you can call it arrogance, whatever you want to say. You know, it's tough for them to admit they have issues. And probably even more scary, you know, when you see stories of my dad or Junior Seau or other, unfortunately, professional athletes that have suffered from CTE or brain damage or whatever you want to call it. You know, you see these kind of stories, and I'm sure there's a part that's, you know, terrifying to admit that you have that problem because, you know, there's no cure yet. You know, so it's tough for those guys to come out and reach out for help. And, you know, I think they've started to make strides where family members can reach out and either let someone know or, you know, teammates can let somebody know, whether it would be within their organization they played for or the league and, you know, the league directly to let, you know, let somebody know anyways, to kind of keep an eye on them or try to find a way to reach out to the family members that are suffering just as much, if not more so than the players, and get them the help they need. Even if it's just something as simple as somebody to talk to or financial help or whatever they need.
Garrett, I wanted to talk a little bit about your dad and your time with him. And it's sort of a multi-pronged question, but when did you guys first start to notice issues popping up with him? And you also lived with him for a stretch too. What was that like?
Well, I know that, you know, during dad's life, you know, we all kind of say when he went to Kansas City was when my mom says she noticed changes in him. Now a lot of that, I do believe, and I think my mom believes also, is that a lot of that was the heartbreak of leaving Pittsburgh. You know, my dad had every intention of retiring a Steeler and, you know, being a coach here and stuff like that. And I think that, and it wasn't a situation where he thought, you know, oh, he was being pushed out as a player or something. No, I don't think it was that, but it was just, I think it was, you know, I've said before, and I think you and I even talked about, is football was kind of at a crossroads there, where before it was kind of the old boys network. You know, you put your life in for the organization, you kind of are rewarded with an ambassadorship, you know, some kind of token job, yep, to stick around and stuff like that. And at the end of the 80s with free agency coming in, and I think a new class of owners for a lot of the teams coming in who kind of didn't, I don't want to say viewed players as assets, but definitely, you know, said, okay, well, we need to move on. We need to make a clean break, you know, get these guys out, you know, not, you know, and you could say it was a cold-hearted way. I don't think necessarily it was always meant that way, but, you know, they were kind of, you know, sent, if they wanted to go somewhere else, they weren't exactly stopping them, you know, and they weren't saying, you know, hey, let's give this guy a job just to kind of hang around the organization and, you know, do nothing and stuff like that, you know, and with the Chief passing away and Dan Rooney taking over, this isn't saying something negative about Dan, is, you know, I think Dan wanted to run the organization his way, and he should have, you know, it's, you got to make changes and you got to put your own stamp on an organization and stuff like that. And I think that a lot of the changes we saw, you know, we'll never know how much of that was the brain injuries taking hold or, you know, his own depression about leaving Pittsburgh and stuff like that. But, you know, that's when my mom, and again, I was 4 years old when my dad left Kansas City, and even my oldest, you know, brothers and sisters were still, you know, around 10 years old. So it's not like, you know, we were mature enough to really notice things. And plus, you know, dad was gone 18 hours a day anyway. So,
yeah.
You know, we didn't really notice that stuff. You know, and that was, you know, that was where kind of where we noticed things. It was more of after dad retired that it really hit home that something was different. You know, we hoped that, and I think every family member who's, you know, I always kind of compared it to having a family member who has a substance abuse problem. You always hope one day they're just kind of going to wake up and be better. You know, they're going to be their old selves and they're going to, you know, act the way they used to, because you'll, even when things were bad, even up to that, you know, that end, when I lived with my dad, cause I lived with him the last 2 years of his life, you would always see glimpses of who he used to be. You know, and you, when you love someone or care about someone, you always take every sign, every positive sign of, okay, this is going to be the turning point. You know, they're going to
get
better now. Yeah. And I think that was, for us family members, that was the most difficult part, was seeing that. You know, I don't know what my dad knew. I don't, you know, cause again, he didn't know he had CTE. There was no CTE and stuff like that. And my dad definitely had the mentality of, if there's an issue mentally, physically, whatever, it can be fixed through hard work and identifying the problem and stuff like that. And I think that's, you know, what he believed, you know, because he would talk many times about, you know, because obviously we had a different situation going on at that point in time about, you know, retirement benefits and stuff like that. You know, he would say to me, one of the reasons he wanted to get that finished and get it taken care of was so he could get back in shape and he could go back to the gym, or he could go back to lifting weights, or he could go back to being employed. And, you know, he would always use the term a functioning member of society. And, you know, I think that was the most difficult thing for him and us, is he never really got better. You know, You'd see those glimpses and stuff like that, but it would never fully take hold. And that was the difficult part. And honestly, the scariest part, because again, every time you see that, you hope he's going to get better. And then when he doesn't, it's just another kick in the gut.
So we're chatting on the Pomp and Joe Show, Jason Mackey in for the guys here with Garrett Webster, Mike Webster's son. And you can follow Garrett at BigWeb52. And I would recommend you do that, because it's an excellent social media account. I love what Garrett does, telling the story of his dad, and the good times, and reminding people that it wasn't just the CTE stuff, that Mike Webster was a wonderful, dedicated family man, obviously a very, very good Steeler and an intense football player and all that stuff. But it's a fun social media follow. You keep it light. You post some funny pictures of yourself and Iron Mike. But I know I appreciate getting the look into somebody like that who has had a career that has been out in the public eye well after he passed away, sometimes for unfortunate reasons. But your goals on social media, Garrett, what do you try to do? What are you trying to convey to people about your dad?
Well, I think, you know, first off, you know, my dad always viewed himself as a regular guy. He never, you know, and that was, you know, the weird thing is, and I've tried to explain this and I try to come off the right way, is, you know, he didn't like putting himself above other people, and he didn't like people who put themselves above, you know, others. And I think one of the most misunderstood things about a lot of the athletes nowadays, and even back then, is they like being treated like regular people. They like being able to go pick up their kids or, you know, go to the store and stuff like that. And you know, obviously talk to people about, you know, their career as Steelers and stuff like that. They don't mind that. but they like to be, to some extent, regular people. And I think with my dad, he had that Pittsburgh sense of humor of, for lack of a better term, breaking each other's balls all the time, or, you know, kind of that playfully ripping on each other and stuff like that. I think that's one of the reasons why dad loved being a Steeler so much and living in this area is, you know, you could rip on Craig Wolfley for his haircut, or, you know, Ton Shilkin for, anything, you know, stuff like that. And I think with dad, with the CTE and stuff like that, obviously that's, you know, unfortunately a very sad story, but there was also a lot of good times. You know, I always like to compare it to the movie Goodfellas. You know, if you really break it down, Goodfellas is a movie about a bunch of sociopaths doing a bunch of terrible, terrible things, but you watch it and there's camaraderie, there's laughs, there's, you know, as weird as that sounds, there's laughs, there's joyfulness and stuff like that, and there's good times in it. And with my dad, I kind of look at it the same way, you know, that there is sad times, you know, with what happened, but there was also a lot of good times through playing, you know, playing in Pittsburgh and interacting with regular members of the community, or, you know, ripping on his teammates, things that everybody does in every, if you've ever played organized sports or you've just been part of a team, whether, or a group of friends, let's say, you know, you take part in those things. And I think sometimes we think that athletes don't do that stuff, or we think that, you know, the big serious football player like Mike Webster, you know, doesn't play jokes on his teammates or his family members or his kids or something like that. And a lot of these guys do those things. And for me, I'm just speaking as myself here, I've always enjoyed stories of athletes, especially the ones that we think of as being the, you know, kind of the ones that are the iconic athletes, I guess you could say. I love hearing stories of them just being regular people, you know, being regular guys, or, you know, playing jokes or doing regular things. I think that that's something that we as society really, really like and get a kick out of. And that's the part of my dad that I try to share, is that, you know, he was, you know, Iron Mike. He did have, you know, let's just say a bad ending to his story, but that doesn't mean there were a lot of good things along that journey. You know, there was a lot of joy and happiness. He did a lot of things to help people. You know, I've heard a lot of stories about dad being involved with spina bifida research, with, you know, going to prisons and doing church, you know, being involved in the church, you know, and all that stuff means a huge amount to me as a son. You know, I love hearing stories. You know, I get texts or messages every day about somebody who says, you know, I was 12 years old and, you know, met your dad at this. And, you know, he spent all day, you know, signing autographs for those kids. Or he talked to me, even though I was a 12-year-old little kid, he talked to me like I was a grown up and took an interest in what I was doing and stuff like that. And, you know, that makes me very proud as a son of my father. And I think that there's a lot of people that those good aspects leave a huge lasting imprint on. And I think sometimes we don't report that stuff about athletes because we'll report about, you know, their 12 catches and 2 touchdowns and stuff like that. But we don't report, hey, you know, this guy after that game spent, you know, 30 minutes signing autographs for kids from, you know, this organization, or, you know, he brought a kid in with spina bifida into the locker room. And, you know, even though he had a colostomy bag, he showed him around and made him feel like, you know, he was a regular kid for 20, 30 minutes. Garrett, and to me, that's what makes these athletes so good.
Garrett, one of the things I loved learning about your dad from your social media feed was that he loved dive restaurants. He was a big Eaton Park fan, would eat, waffles with strawberries and whipped cream, would crush root beer floats, would go to like King's or Denny's or something, was not a fancy man.
Oh, no, it's my favorite stuff with him, and how I guess I'll always remember when it comes to the kind of interacting with, you know, the public is, now he would not go to autograph shows too often at, you know, especially at the end there. You know, he was having difficulties and he was very cognizant of, let's just say he was embarrassed by a situation. I don't like to use that term because, you know, obviously it's a little depressing, but, you know, if it was an autograph show where there was going to be fair food, so, you know, funnel cakes, nachos, you know, that kind of corn dogs, that kind of stuff, you know, we could usually convince him to go. I remember he'd go and he'd have these people coming up with probably, you know, thousands of dollars, you know, memorabilia. You know, I remember once there was this lithograph they did when Three Rivers closed. And, you know, it was something, you know, everybody had signed it from those 70s teams. You know, this was multi-thousand dollars, you know, thing. And this guy was clearly his, you know, he had, you know, and good Lord, good luck getting Lambert to sign something. You know, and he had him sign it, Jack Ham, Terry Bradshaw, you know, and he gives it to my dad, you know, and he says, you're the last one I need. And dad's sitting there, he's got this thing in his lap, he's balancing a funnel cake covered in powdered sugar in the other hand. And he knows the guy is nervous as hell that, you know, what is he going to say? You know, please don't sign this because, you know, you've got a funnel cake in your hand.
Right.
You know, so my dad, he had to purposely know that this guy was nervous. Cause so he would get it as close as possible to dripping funnel cake powdered sugar all over the damn picture. But he would sit there and he would sign autographs for hours with funnel cakes in one end, and he would have people just running over to get him funnel cakes or Rip Your Floats or whatever while he signed stuff.
You can't beat a good funnel cake, by the way,
memorabilia
Garrett.
Collections. Huh?
You can't beat a good funnel cake either. I mean, but I respect you're eating Sour Patch Kids, but funnel cake sounds a lot better now.
You can't, but American fair food is, you know, personally, in my opinion, our greatest accomplishment as a country. You know, you can go and get something, you know, you can get a stick of butter, deep fried in butter, wrapped in bacon, and, you know, filled with steak. You know, to me, I'm sorry, what else do you want? You know, that's it. You know, it's all downhill from there.
Yeah. Last thing for you, man. I know that things weren't always super tight between you guys and the Steelers. Some of, you know, the end of Mike's career and some of the way things went, you know, I don't want to forced an estrangement or something, but it just wasn't as sort of cozy as it is now. I understand Art Rooney II was a very big part in that and sort of pulling you and your mom closer, and now you guys are included in a lot of Steelers things and, you know, are really treated like alumni and you get to be around a lot of things. I know it means a lot to you. Just how would you describe that evolution and what has happened with, you know, having your dad be a closer part of the team's legacy?
Well, I think that after, you know, and I've said this with some, and I think it's a similar situation with some of Dad's former teammates, is when Dad was struggling, I think everybody, there was, you know, if you lived in Pittsburgh during that time and you paid kind of attention to those old Steelers teams, it was kind of an open secret that my dad was having a rough time. And I think that, you know, the Steelers organization is different from a lot of organizations that a lot of people that were there for life. You know, they were there from 1970 to 1995 or, you know, whatever. So there was a lot of people and a lot of them, you know, Dad really loved the office staff guys, the equipment guys, you know, everybody up and down the organization. And I think that it was very tough for everybody involved with what my dad was going through, you know, from, you know, do we get, cause again, I mean, he was, you know, I always say my dad's deadliest sin was pride. And, you know, everybody knew, you know, this was Iron Mike. How do you reach out and get him help? How do you talk to him? How do you do that? And also for my dad, how do I reach out to these people and let them know that I'm struggling in this way? And, you know, you add on, like we just talked about, a head injury stuff that nobody really had scientific proof of and had a 100%, you know, definitive, this is what's going on. And I think it was very difficult for both sides to get the help that my dad needed and to, you know, reach out to from either side. And I think both sides did at certain times. You know, I know there were times the Steelers put him up, you know, in a hotel or tried to get him a job or would try to do something. And, you know, I think that for lack of a better term, it was a lot of miscommunications and just, you know, I guess both sides, best way to put it, both sides failed in to help each other out during that time. And we as family members, you know, we didn't know what was going on. We just looked at it as my dad used to work there. He's, you know, supposedly one of the most beloved and important. And we also knew how close Dad was with the chief. You know, why aren't we included in more things? Why aren't we part of stuff? You know, and we didn't stop to think, well, you know, maybe we are being invited, but Dad's just not accepting or Dad's making it clear he doesn't want to go, whether it's because he's embarrassed about his situation or not that he, you know, would have been. I think that, you know, I would be very surprised if anyone in the organization or any of its former teammates would have ever let Dad feel embarrassed in any kind of situation. But it's tough as a family because Dad didn't talk a lot about that stuff. And, you know, he was always kind of uncomfortable with attention when he was doing well. So if you take somebody who's uncomfortable with public attention for the accolades he's receiving, he's going to be even worse when it comes to attention for the difficulties he's having. And I think that it took, as sad as this may sound, I think Dad passing away was the only way that rift was going to heal between our family and, you know, the Steelers. And I think it took a little while. I think it took, you know, Art kind of reaching out. And I think that that's, again, you know, I know there's criticism, certain things with Art and, you know, how the team's been built and stuff like that. But I think the thing is, if you look at the Steelers organization, I think Art is Art the Second is much more like Art the First. You know, you see, you know, you even see guys, you know, you saw TJ Watt sign his new contract the other day, and the picture Steelers social media posted was him and his wife. You know, it wasn't just him and a visor sacking a quarterback. And I think Art has gotten back to that part of the Steelers that it was a family organization. And that's something that I think we as fans maybe don't appreciate as much because we want to see the team win. But I think it's something that does pay off in the long term, both on the field and also with the guys who used to play here. You know, the guys who used to, you know, represent the organization. Because, you know, it wasn't just my dad. There was a lot of guys and former players who had bad feelings about the organization when they left. And I think that Art has done a lot of great work of healing those rifts and reaching out to guys and understanding if negative things were said. You know I've certainly said, you know, my share of negative things about the organization, things that I'm embarrassed about today. But I think he also knows, and hopefully a lot of people in the organization knows, is that was coming from a place of ignorance and pain. You know, and when you're in that kind of situation, you lash out at whoever and whatever's out there. And I think Art's done a great job at healing that, of reaching out to guys and making them feel welcome, you know, at games or at, you know, events, or even just, you know, hey, if you got to reach out and get help, you know, I know that they reach out now much better than they used to be. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And, you know, I really hope the Steelers take that and really run with doing things for their former alumni and helping them out in many situations. And it doesn't always have to be with money or paying rent. You know, getting them on their feet, getting their families comfortable with how their lives are, and making sure they're taken care of and know that they're loved, and you know, they want them to be healthy and have good lives post-retirement.
Garrett Webster, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, take care. Garrett Webster, Mike Webster's son, just a fantastic follow. Check him out on X or Twitter, at BigWeb52. Reliving Mike Webster's legacy. And I think it's an appropriate topic. The Steelers reporting to training camp, something Iron Mike loved. It's been 20 years since the transformative paper from Dr. Bennett Amalu changed the way we think about concussions and CTE in athletes. And Garrett does a fantastic job, again, remembering his dad, the good, the bad, being honest with it in a way that I think Iron Mike would really approve of. And it's an unfortunate thing. And he and his mom, they did a lot for concussion research and how people think about concussions now. And it hasn't been the easiest ride for the Webster clan, that's for sure. Limits, can you imagine walking into like Eaton Park or Denny's and Mike Webster sitting there crushing waffles? That would be something.
Not at all. That would be, that would probably just blow you away. Like, I just could not imagine what that would be like. Or if, you know, you saw like Ben doing that, or you right. saw the Chief, you saw Dan Rooney just hanging out in Eaton Park.
I love it. And
like
Eaton,
you and
Eaton
me.
Park waffles, I mean, very good. You can't turn that down.
Yes, the Eaton Park on 51, a very frequent spot that we would go to in
Same.
Grade school and high school.
Yep. Same here, man. Same here. Again, thanks to Garrett Webster for that. And it's the Pomp and Joe Show on a beautiful Thursday. Jason Mackey, Austin Bechtold in for the guys. Thanks so much for finding us, having a great time hanging out with you here today. Fan Hotlines presented by Sullivan Super Service, Pittsburgh's trusted plumbing and HVAC provider for over 50 years. You can listen to the Pomp and Joe Show on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, so before the break, I talked about some of the defensive starters that the Steelers said goodbye to and where that impact will be felt the most. I'm going to roll that question out to Limits as well, and we're going to kick that around. But first, kind of set the stage, defensive line Larry Ogunjobi is gone. Landon Roberts, linebacker, gone. Minkah Fitzpatrick, safety, gone. Dante Jackson, cornerback, gone. I think you can cross two names off the board pretty easily. Larry Ogunjobi and Dante Jackson, I would not put near the top of that list.
Nope.
Would you agree?
Nope, it's probably better for the team that both are gone, yeah. Especially with Ogunjobi's salary.
Yeah, I don't see the juice justifying the squeeze there. But the other two I think are interesting. Is the loss of a Landon Roberts or the loss of Minkah Fitzpatrick going to be felt more? And it feels a couple years ago that would be an insane question to ask. Minkah Fitzpatrick taken out of the Steelers lineup, my goodness, of course they're going to be worse off. And I still think that's probably the answer to the question. But I think about a Landon Roberts and their run defense and how much they need to change. And I kind of miss them. And I want to see Peyton Wilson take an important next step this year. I want to see Cole Holcomb come back and contribute. I think Patrick Queen can be a lot better than he was last year. I do think Patrick Queen was probably better than we give him credit for after kind of a slow start. And I think the answer to it ultimately is they'll feel Minka Fitzpatrick's loss more. But I wish they would have re-signed a Landon Roberts. I'm worried that could become a miss. And I think it's closer than maybe we would answer on first blush. What do you think, Limits?
So I was talking about this a decent amount yesterday, especially with Landon Roberts. He's somebody that I definitely would have brought back. Jason, overall last year as a run defender, Landon Roberts was elite. He was the best linebacker, according to PFF, in run defense. And they brought in Malik Harrison to be able to replace him, and he hasn't really gotten a lot of run because he'll end up being a backup, and Cole Holcomb's also back healthy. But Landon Roberts also did not sign a big deal in Vegas. Like, it was only a couple of million. Why not bring him back, especially on running downs? You know the team, or at least your best guessing, is going to run the football, which the Steelers struggled a lot in doing defensively against the run, especially late in the season. I feel like Roberts would have been logistically the right guy to bring back, especially with the deal that Harrison got. What, 2 years and 10 million?
10 mil. Yep.
It just made too much sense to bring Landon Roberts back. I didn't like the move.
I know. I didn't like it either. I liked the Minka Fitzpatrick trade. I'm actually totally fine with that. We'll see what happens with Jalen Ramsey. I do think it's going to be an amalgamation of roles. I don't think he's going to be in any one set spot. I'm eager to see him play outside some, play in the slot some. I don't think he'd be overmatched or out of position at safety. I do worry a little bit about Juan Thornhill just staying healthy and having a productive year, but I sort of get what Omar Khan is doing, and that's something I learned from hearing those people talk and listening to audio and whatever yesterday, that like Juan Thornhill has played a version of what the Steelers tried to do with Minka Fitzpatrick. Like, if you look at his past couple of years, like, no, he was not an elite safety. You can look up PFF numbers and all this stuff and you know, paint a case that he was not a very good player. At the same time, if you're going to put him in a secondary with potentially a nickel situation where you have Joey Porter Jr., Darius Slay, Jalen Ramsey, and Deshaun Elliott also on the field with him, like, all Juan Thornhill basically needs to do is keep plays in front of him. You're not looking at, you know, a huge drop-off or huge responsibility. My question is whether he can stay on the field. That's been a problem for him. But I do think it's an interesting debate, because what we're talking about, what Limits was saying about stopping the run and how good a Landon Roberts was, and that other position being kind of a safety valve, a safety net, somebody that, you know, not asked to do a whole lot, and the way the Steelers could configure their secondary, that person is going to have minimal responsibility. I also think that if you kind of parse through Omar Khan's words yesterday, that they're not done at safety, nor should they be. That was one of my takeaways. Omar Khan had every opportunity to say, like, we signed Juan Thornhill. He's got a history. He's played well before. We believe in him. He's our guy, whatever. And I know you're never going to be that exact as a team builder, but Omar Khan was definitely not that. Like, he basically said, we have Juan Thornhill under contract, and, you know, we'll see kind of where things go.
Well, I kind of took his comments, Jason, as him saying just how much he loves the team, how much he loves the roster, the moves that they've made, as kind of him saying they're not going to make at least a significant move at safety. Maybe
they should add depth.
Like, would Justin Simmons be a significant move in your mind?
It would in my mind. I don't know if it would be in Omar's mind.
Right, because it would be in my mind as well. So let's say hypothetically Omar does not think that that is a big move. Then sure. I agree, and I think that that's ultimately a move that they should make. But based on what Omar said, I kind of think they're okay standing pat unless somebody blows them away or somebody's free agent number comes down.
I hope not.
I hope not either.
Limits. I want some depth there, man. I've got some concerns. I mean, what if Juan Thornhill would succumb to injuries the way he has the past couple of years?
There's no one behind him right now. It's
that
Sebastian
is a very
Castro,
big problem.
And he's never played a snap in the NFL.
I you could make the case, and some have, that that's a bigger hole in the Steelers roster right now than wide receiver. I almost feel better about, you know, you've got DK Metcalf, Jonnu Smith, whatever. Calvin Austin is going to be in there somewhere. You're counting on maybe a little bit too much at this point from Roman Wilson, but there's at least something there behind Juan Thornhill.
There's upside with Wilson,
Sebastian Castro, I'm sorry. Training camp, off-season darling or not, I'm not feeling real good about that.
Well, now, if that's the case, they're going to end up probably with special packages where, I mean, who plays deep safety? Who knows? Maybe it's a Corey Trice type of role for him, where Tomlin said Joey Porter Jr., Darius Slay, Jalen Ramsey will all be on the field together at the same time, like at all times. So you know those three will be out there. Plus, you'll have Deshaun Elliott. Is that ultimately going to limit Thornhill's exposure, or are they going to go with one less linebacker? How are they going to make that work with the three corners on the field?
I know.